You're listening to an iHeart podcast.
Murder is murder is murder, right? I disagree. Because in this case, a young woman, a mom, 27-year-old Brandi Peters, is murdered, no doubt about it. But also murdered, her three little children. Twin girls, age 6, and a baby boy, just 3 years old. There were many times in front of a jury I did not know how I could get through testimony or an opening or a closing without crying. I did it. There were a few times I would ask to leave the courtroom and take a recess to compose myself. But I got to tell you, this case is tough. But I want you to hear the evidence. Nancy Gray's Crime Stories.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
It's news that has shocked this Tallahassee neighborhood.
We had a neighbor who called us out of concern, and we responded to try and look around the house and so forth, and that's when we discovered the bodies.
A woman along with her three kids all found dead inside of their house here on the 900 block of Saddle Creek Run Road. The mother and her kids, 6-year-old twin girls and a 3-year-old little boy, police say, are now victims of foul play.
Does appear to be violence involved.
David McCraney with the Tallahassee Police Department says what exactly happened still remains a mystery. Police spent much of the day collecting evidence to try to figure that out.
As we go into this scene, it's very expansive, a lot of detail involved to make sure that we don't miss anything or make a mistake. So things are a little slow right now, but progress is being made.
McCraney says only the four lived inside of the house. He says they're now speaking with relatives and other acquaintances to find out what other relationships the family may have had. Police say they're now working with the state attorney's office to gather the evidence they need, but say it may be some time before they figure out what happened.
I can't get over it. Twins, age 6, Tamaya and Tanaya. Javante, age 3, and mom, Brandi, all dead. A gruesome crime scene that police, investigators, CSI are still reeling from the memories. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. Thank you for being with us, with me, an all-star panel. Jason Oceans, veteran defense attorney, joining me from New York. Stephen Lampley, detective, author of Outside Your Door at StephenLampley.com. Dr. Debbie Jaffe Ellis, my sparring partner, psychologist, adjunct professor, Columbia University. A renowned medical examiner, Dr. Chris Sperry, retired chief medical examiner for the entire state of Georgia and no stranger to the courtroom and cross-examination. But right now, to crimeonline.com investigative reporter Levi Page. Levi, this, in my mind, sounds like a scenario that you would hear about in another country, a third world country, where a whole family is just wiped out. It's overwhelming, especially what gets to me. The twins, Tamaya, Tanaya, just 6 years old, and the little 3-year-old. All dead. Tell me, let's just start at the beginning, Levi Page, and tell me what led police to the location.
So Nancy, neighbors in this very quiet community in Tallahassee, Florida, found blood coming out from the front door of a home. And they called 911 and law enforcement responded to a horrific scene. As you mentioned, blood splatter was everywhere. Bullet holes riddled this home, and there was a violent murder. 38-year-old Brandi Peters was shot. Investigators also believe she was beat with a large object, and her three children were also found dead.
Okay, whoa. You just told me something new I didn't know.
Yes.
You're telling me there was shooting and bludgeoning?
Yes, she was beat with a large object.
Okay, that really changes things for me. Motive death is extremely important. Let me go to Dr. Chris Sperry, former chief medical examiner, state of Georgia, because it's one thing to, for instance, do a home invasion and you want something, whatever that may be in that home, and you gun everybody down and you hightail it. But it's a different scenario. And I guess I'm going to have to go to Dr. Debbie Jaffe Ellis after Sperry, because it's a psychological element when you have close contact. I've called it in the past sweetheart killing. Not that there's anything sweet about a murder, but there's an intimate contact. When you're close enough to your victim, you're 2 feet away from them, that you are bludgeoning them or pushing them down. That's a whole different mindset of killing, and it leads me to the killer. Dr. Chris Sperry, if someone is shot dead, how do you also find bludgeoning evidence, and what does that mean to you?
Well, we rarely find bludgeoning. Shooting is very quick, convenient, expedient, and it basically takes care of business. But bludgeoning somebody requires, just as you said, close contact and, fear, too, that the victim may overpower the assailant, or there could be a prolonged struggle, something like that. To have bludgeoning combined with a gunshot wound really strongly suggests to me that there's a relationship between the two people, some type of emotional bond that has gone awry, and the perpetrator is really going overboard excessively to hurt the victim and hurt them badly, and to make sure they are dead.
You know, interesting that you said that, because the mom in this scenario, Brandy, was shot 8 times. As a matter of fact, take a listen to the medical examiner, Dr. Lisa Flanagan.
The most severe injury on her whole body was the injury there to her forehead, where it basically was open, where I could see found it inside her head.
Should have a pointer there.
Okay. It went right here. This was all crushed in and fractured, and the brain was exposed. These are diagrams of the right and left sides of her head. The upper photo on the right side of her head, there are several lacerations. And this diagram also shows a gunshot wound there to her right ear.
Several lacerations, and the brain was actually exposed. How does that happen, Dr. Sperry?
Well, from multiple very hard blows from a very, very hard object. The skull is not only cracked, but it's crushed. And the underlying brain is also crushed and disrupted. And so with multiple overlapping blows like this, the damage is so great that the brain is exposed. And the brain is very, very soft, too. So it doesn't take much to start fragmenting the brain. But to get there is a lot more work. So there was multiple blows that were expended on this poor young lady's head.
Okay, listen to more of the medical examiner, Dr. Lisa Flanagan, explaining about defensive wounds on mom Brandy. Can you imagine the fight she put up to save her 3 children?
She had significant injuries on her hands. There were fractures of 2 fingers on this side, and then a fracture of her middle finger, and the tip of her left little finger was partially amputated. There were abrasions on the backs of her fingers, and then some skin tears as well.
Hey, Lisa. Are these injuries what you characterize as defensive type injuries?
We use the term defense type injuries because when someone is fighting off an attacker and they're trying to protect their body, then they'll put their hands up or their arms, and injuries that are inflicted when someone's trying to protect their body are the wounds that we will call defense type wounds.
Defensive wounds. What do we mean by that? Let me go to Stephen Lampley, detective, author of Outside Your Door. What's your interpretation of defensive wounds?
Nancy, it's anything that somebody would do to protect themselves or their family. For instance, it's if in a knife attack or in a gun attack, they might put their hands up in effort to deflect the blows or the knife, and then you would receive wounds on the palm or the underside of your arm. Things like that is what we're looking for. Those are typically defensive wounds.
It was so bad, as a matter of fact, Jackie Howard here in the studio with Dave Mack telling me one of her fingers was actually gone. To Dr. Chris Sperry, I remember the first time I ever heard the words defensive wounds. I was in college, in undergrad. I knew nothing about crime. You know, I was just fat, dumb, and happy, living my life, no idea about what was going on in the world. And I remember hearing about a shooting, and it must have been in Valdosta, where I went to college for a little over a year, where a woman held a hand up as someone came into her home. She was sitting on her bed, held her hand up, and the bullet that would have hit her in the head hit her in the hand and went through, I think, her chin instead. A defensive wound. I remember the first time I heard the phrase defensive wound. Dr. Chris Sperry, I'm sure you will recall a murder case I tried in inner city Atlanta of a millionaire's wife who ostensibly died of smoke inhalation, but was covered in defensive wounds, even on her knees. Explain how you can determine whether bruises are defensive wounds or not.
Well, defensive wounds are in locations where a person would raise their hands, raise their arms, or say if they're laying on their back, you would raise their feet or legs, try to ward off blows or, you know, keep the assailant from striking the head, the face, or the body. And so when you see injuries like this on the hands, on the wrists, the forearms, on the knees, on the legs or feet that are out of context, you know, that really don't have another decent explanation over the course of the whole assault, the possibility of defensive wounds becomes very, very strong. And especially also depending on how the person is attacked as well. If it's a knife, a cutting instrument, a club, a ball bat, you know, it's very unusual for the assailant to get, you know, one strike and incapacitate the person. It's usually an onslaught of blows, and the victim is raising their hands, raising their legs. You know, if they're on the ground, I've seen defensive wounds on the bottoms of people's feet just from when they're on the ground trying to push away the assailant and instead receiving blows on their feet. So it really, you know, it's a part of the totality of looking at the case. And you're separating out injuries that are meant solely to be lethal and injuries that have another explanation.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Law enforcement officers responded to the Saddle Creek Run home on November 20th, 2010. Law enforcement officers respond. They get a call. It was actually Artron Timmons who went up there first to do a check because his mom calls him and tells him to go look, but they haven't heard anything from Brandy Peters that day. He walks up and sees blood outside the home. He calls law enforcement. Officer Jernigan, Officer Kidd respond first and foremost, and they approach the home. They go into the home, and they are able to force entry by breaking a window, and they realized what was happening there. They're later joined by Sean Wyman, Officer Tallahassee Police Department, and they go into the home, and they found what you've already seen.
You are hearing Florida ASA John Fuchs describing what happened in the home of Brandy Peters, just 27 years old. Brandy Peters, dead. Twins, age 6, Tamaya Tenaya, and a little 3-year-old sibling, all dead. But why? Back to Levi Page, CrimeOnline.com investigative reporter. So a neighbor contacts police. Police get there. Then what happens?
And they discover the bodies, Nancy. Brandy Peters, she was shot. Her twins, Tamia and Tania, were killed in different ways. Tamia was shot, and Tania was drowned. Also drowned was Javonte.
Oh, whoa. Only wait a minute. Now this is getting crazy. We've got 3 modes of death. That tells me a lot about the killer. A home intruder would just shoot. First of all, it's doubtful to me that a home intruder.
There was no forced entry. No forced entry into the home.
a home intruder would just, a home invader would come in. Very rarely do you see them kill children. Now, we did see that in the D.C. mansion murders. But typically, a home invader, a home intruder, does not kill children statistically. When you see dead children, murdered children, there is typically a closer connection or it's sex-related. Also, when you have a home invader, you don't see three modes of death. Jason Oceans, a veteran defense attorney, no stranger to a courtroom. You've got shooting, you've got bludgeoning, and now two of the children were drowned. That is a personal connection. It defies statistics of home invaders.
You're correct, Nancy. It shows, either a crime of passion to someone the victims knew or were familiar with, or it's a purposeful contract killing where there was a revenge factor for something else at this point, potentially unknown. So the multiple levels of the modes of murder, the drowning, beating, shooting, all indicate either a connectivity that's personal to the victims, to the perpetrator, or in fact that there's something more, either revenge involving a greater level of violence,
you know,
for purposefulness.
You're right. I don't know what that last phrase was, greater level of violence for purposefulness. Okay, I'll try to just soak that in for a moment.
Soak it in, like a contract killing, something that involves...
I mean, are you serious? A contract killing on a 27-year-old mom of three? Okay. To Dr. Debbie Jaffe Ellis, psychologist and adjunct professor, Columbia University. Dr. Debbie, we also know that the children's bodies were stacked up in the bathtub, like you put boxes on top of each other. Now, I'm just a civilian. I'm just a JD. You're the shrink extraordinaire, and I mean no offense by that. I mean, Columbia University, that ain't shabby. Dr. Debbie, in my experience prosecuting homicides, when there is a random killing, the killer doesn't take time to stage the scene. They don't hang around the crime scene and think, wow, I'll stack the children's bodies up in the bathtub. No, they do their business, whether it's a burglary, a robbery, a sex assault, and they leave. They get out of there. They do the deed. They do the killing. They're gone. They don't stick around to stage or manipulate the crime scene, Dr. Debbie.
Yeah. From everything I've heard from you and your guests so far, Nancy, it sounds like whoever the perpetrator was may have had a need to show he had the ultimate power and control over the victims. It sounds like it's possible that he or she felt their strength, or if it was a man, his manlihood was being questioned or threatened, and perhaps a desire to prove to the victims that there was no inadequacy and he was the boss, or she.
Okay, Dr. Debbie Jaffe Ellis, okay, you know how much I love you.
Thanks, Nancy.
And I recognize your brilliance and your education. And I certainly would never question qualifications of a professor at Columbia University. But, okay, here comes the other foot. Why are you pretending it's a woman? Because, I mean, I know that's all PC, politically correct. But statistically, another woman would never do this. Now, very often when women commit murder, they kill their own children. But Levi Page, is there any indication that Brandi Peters' death, the mom, was suicide?
There's no indication, Nancy. And law enforcement immediately suspected that it was someone that she knew. They didn't know who did it, but when they arrived at the scene, they immediately thought that it was someone that she knew because there was no signs of a forced entry into the home, and the home was locked.
Well, I get it, but that no signs of forced entry, and you're saying the home was locked?
Yes, they couldn't get in. When police arrived, they had to
got
break
it.
The window
That's right.
to gain entry.
So, Dr. Sperry, isn't it true you can look at injuries and determine if it was a suicide? I mean, for somebody like you, that's child's play.
Pretty much. It's the vast majority of these are very straightforward, yes.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
DNA, cell phone records, and enough debt to want to kill.
Fair to say that something happened around this time period that caused her to stop using her phone?
Fair to say, yes.
And during?
Records are consistent with that, yes.
Phone records put Henry Segura near the crime the day it happened and even show communication between him and victim Brandy Peters. But DNA testing wasn't quite as conclusive about him being at the crime scene.
Mr. Segura and all four victims are excluded as having contributed to the DNA found on that projectile.
Yes.
The testing never presented a strong enough match to say the DNA belonged to Segura. Plus, testing also showed DNA for an unknown woman. Then there's the motive. $20,000 behind in child support payments for a son Segura thought wasn't even his. He wrote many letters to the Florida Department of Revenue.
In the message, she stated that I was stupid for signing a birth certificate for a child that was not even mine.
All key elements that the state presented to jurors in court Tuesday to suggest Henry Segura killed his mistress, Brandy Peters, their son, Javonte, and her twin daughters, Tamaya and Tanaya.
You were just hearing our friends at WTXL, ABC 27. That was Jada Williams. I got a question. This is something I don't quite get. Jason Oceans, why are they referring to her as a mistress? She is a mother of three, and one of the three belongs to Henry Segura. So she's the mother of his child. Why are they portraying the dead victim as a mistress, like she's some big tramp?
Yeah, I hear that in the description, and it does bother me as well. It's it quite sexist and creates a negative connotation. Apparently, he had an extramarital affair with the victim. I too object to that.
Well, I certainly would not brag about it, Jason Oceans, defense attorney. Another thing, Jason Oceans, you and I are both very familiar with proving parenthood. This guy was 20,000. Now, I heard what the reporter said. She said the DNA was not conclusive to match up to Henry Segura, the father of the baby, the three-year-old. I hear that. But I also heard he owed $20,000 in back child support and that he still denied the baby was his. Jason Oceans, to get child support ordered, you very often have to have a DNA test. If he had any questions about this being his child, he would have contested it in court.
Yeah, you would have had to have had, in order to obtain the child support, since they weren't married and not the putative father, you would have had to have had an order of filiation. Court ordered and get some DNA and make that determination. So,
here's another issue to figure out, Jason Oceans. Here's another issue. Levi Page, CrimeOnline.com investigative reporter. Is it true that Segura was also, quote, dating, quote, that's certainly putting perfume on the pig, three other women at the time?
Yes, and he also had a wife that he was married to with three children.
You know, it just never ends. Dr. Debbie Jaffe Ellis, a psychologist, adjunct professor, Columbia University. You said something earlier that at first it didn't persuade me, but now actually it is. Not the fact that it could have been a woman killer, but you said something about control. And I don't know how to verbalize this, Dr. Debbie, and I'm sure you're going to do a better job than I would. I'd have to write this out for a closing argument and learn it verbatim, but when you've got an individual like Henry Segura, and he's playing all these different women like they're puppets, dating three other women, plus Brandy Peters has his son, plus he's married, that's five women he's either sleeping with or seeing. It is control. You said this is about control, and you're manipulating other people's lives through deceit. Could you put a label on that for me? Because I don't know the word for that except liar.
It's hard for me to find just one label, but I think in addition to the apparent need for control may be a need for people to recognize that he has full power and control. And if anyone were to question that, or if he is made to think that others are questioning his potency and manliness, then to prove that he is the king of the universe, he, fueled by rage, hatred, and resentment, just commits these violent acts.
Okay, I've got a little update from here in the studio. Levi Page, I'm very disappointed in you. Let me just put that out there. Because Jackie Howard, wrong or right, is saying that the three other women, in addition to the wife and the murder victim, Brandi Peters, were in Tallahassee that we know of. And apparently there were other girlfriends in Alabama.
And another one in Minnesota.
Okay. Well, hold, wait, I've got to make a flow chart. Three in Tallahassee, the wife, the victim, one in Minnesota, and an indefinite number in Alabama. I mean, I've got a question. Stephen Lampley, detective, author, outside your door. How does he have time to commit a murder? He's gallivanting between Alabama, Tallahassee, Minnesota, and the Lord only knows where else to see all these women.
Well, Nancy, apparently he made time at some point along the way, too. And I'm seeing also in this, I'm picking up on some anger issues.
You mean me?
But apparently,
you mean me or him?
Time to him on him the suspect. I'm picking up on some maybe perhaps, and I'm no psychologist, but I'm picking up on some anger issues with this gentleman. But back to your question, it appears as though he made time to do this. Maybe he let some other women on the side go while he could commit these murders.
Guys, I'm looking right now, and you can see it at crimeonline.com. And Jackie, I want to make sure that you have this posted there. A Facebook photo of these two little twins. Oh, my stars. They are precious. I'm pretty sure one of them has on a hot pink. It's going to be Ariel or what's the princess? Oh, Brave. Brave. Isn't that a princess with red hair? I can see some red hair peeking out. And the other one has on a pale pink t-shirt that looks like it may be a Frozen. And they are back-to-back, big smiles. They've got their hair meticulously done, just like long hair. And you know how much time that takes the mom, Brandi, to do all that hair. Lucy's hair, Jason, you wouldn't believe it. You got to look at her on Facebook. You know, it was short and curly. Well, she wanted to let it grow out. I was against it, but I picked my battles for tattoos, sorry, Sperry, and body piercings, and I let her do it. It's almost down to her waist, and it is, you know, to brush that. These little girls' hair is so long, and she's got it in an updo. And they're just precious. Their little ears are pierced, and they are, oh, beautiful brown eyes, and they both have perfect smiles. They're dead. Their dead bodies were stacked on top of each other, along with their three-year-old little brother in the bathtub. And mommy fought like a bear, like a tiger, to save her three children. Henry Segura, the baby boy's dad, cell phone places him in the area at the time on the phone with her just before Brandi Peters is murdered. But we got to have more than a cell phone call.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
You're going to hear throughout the course of this that he was interviewed by Tallahassee Police Department on two different occasions, days apart. First one was to notify them of the death of his son, and the second was follow-up. And what he did is he lied to law enforcement. He said, I was not there. I was at home the entire time. Tallahassee Police Department did their investigation, realized he was lying, called him in for a second interview.
to clarify. I was at home all the time. Check my cell phone records. They say I was there. But he made a mistake. He thought he could pull one over the eyes of the Tallahassee Police Department. What they did is they found out he had a separate phone number that he didn't tell them about. And what they did when they checked that cell phone record is they determined he was in fact there at the time that Brandi Peters and the kids were killed.
You are hearing Florida ASA John Fuchs describing an incredible lie allegedly told by the bio dad, Henry Segura, age 41, 27-year-old Brandi Peters, dead after fighting like a tiger to save her three children, Tamaya, Tanaya, and Javante, all murdered and stacked up like boxes, dead in the bathtub. Levi Page, CrimeOnline.com investigative reporter. So let me understand this. Suspect Henry Segura brags to police, hey, I was nowhere near there. You know, check out my cell phone. I was with my wife. And then it turns out he's got more than one cell phone. Explain.
Yes, he had a secret cell phone that he used to keep up with all the women that he was having an affair with. And you're right, Nancy, he did deny being at the home of the victims. But then police say that his phone pinged at a tower near the home, and then he admitted that he was there and then left. He said that he didn't want to admit it because he didn't want his wife to find out that he was having affairs.
So he's saying that all of his nefarious actions, deleting texts, having a double cell phone, all this was to keep his wife from finding out. I mean, how could she not know with all of these girlfriends?
So apparently she had known that he had had affairs in the past, but he had convinced her that he was no longer having any affairs, and he didn't want her to find out that he was continuing his extramarital affairs.
To Stephen Lampley, detective, author of Outside Your Door, Stephen Lampley, every PI knows that when you have a person with multiple cell phones, something ain't right. In the famous words of Dr. Fung, something is wrong. Remember that in the O.J. Simpson case? Something is wrong. When your husband has multiple cell phones, you better check the phone history.
Nancy, that's correct. Now, there are some occasions, and I have been guilty of that as well, where I would have one cell phone that I had for work and one for personal use. But that's something that can be checked out pretty quick. But when you have a cell phone for personal reasons, too.
Oh, you're different from all the other guys? You're different from all the other guys cheating. Okay, actually, for a period of time, when I was at Court TV and at HLN, I had two cell phones. One was a leftover, and then I got another one issued. I got rid of them because my son, John David, would get on one and play games, and I knew, okay, that's got to go. But they certainly were not secret cell phones. Speaking of cell phones, speaking of phone records, take a listen to this call that Segura gets.
And she told you that your son was either missing or dead, right?
Yes, sir. Well, she said he was. She said that she heard that they couldn't find him. Is what she said. Said people saying they thought that he was with the guy Caleb.
Okay. And she also tells you those two little girls that you spent a year with that called you daddy were also dead, right?
Yes. And Brandi.
And Brandi.
Yes.
Yet you never made a phone call to Brandi. You never made a phone call to law enforcement. You never made a phone call to anybody to check on that situation, did you?
What could I do about the situation?
Find out if your son was dead or whether he was with somebody else.
Well, when she told me that she wasn't sure if he was dead or not, that was over the phone when I called her to make an appointment to get my son's hair braided. Once I went to her house to get my son's hair braided, she then told me that, you know, they found Javante. He was in the house. He died, too.
Okay, let me understand this. To Dr. Debbie Jaffe Ellis, psychologist, adjunct professor, Columbia University, Dr. Debbie, he gets a call from his female hairdresser telling him that Brandi Peters, 27-year-old girlfriend, and his son and the two twins he was raising are all dead. And he doesn't make a single inquiry. He just picks up his other son and goes to the hairdresser. No questions asked. Now, how am I supposed to believe that is not evidence of guilt?
I wouldn't ask you to believe that it's not evidence of guilt. I think that it is. Yeah, there's no surprise, there's no shock, there's no horror. I think it is evidence of guilt.
To you, Jason Oceans, veteran defense attorney, how do you get your way? How do you claw your way out of that?
Well, you know, in and of itself, I mean, I'm sure the doctor can tell you there are people that are, you know, don't react normally or as we perceive normal to be, whatever that is, to those types of issues. They're dispassionate, they're cold, something else takes over and they have zero reaction. Where we would all expect something more significant. So in and of itself, yeah, it's different from what we perceive as the normal or average response to something like this. But that's not ultimately going to be, you know, the totality of the disposition of guilt. So it's certainly something to work with, but there's enough in the field relative to how people react. Not everyone does to those types of things. It's certainly strange and you got to work with it. But yeah, that's a challenge, Nancy, in and of itself. I agree.
Levi Page, investigative reporter, crimeonline.com. He denies he's there. How is it proven that he was there, or was it?
Well, when his cell phone data shows that he was there, he admitted that he lied to police. He did say that he was there, but then left.
As a matter of fact, cell phone records take center stage in the courtroom. Take a listen.
Did Henry Segura lie about being at the house on that day that many times? Why did Henry Segura set up an alibi with his phone, knowing full well that he was at his house? Why? Why was her cell phone taken? The only thing at his house that's been taken in this situation is her cell phone. Why? We're going to talk about that because it was incriminating against him. Why? Why is there only one void pattern in the blood spatter? One. A void pattern is a situation in which blood spatter is made and it is blocked by an object, specifically as we're talking about the person that perpetrated this event. There's only one void pattern. If there were more than one person, there would be more than one void spot, and there is not. There is one void pattern.
To Dr. Chris Sperry, what is a void pattern?
A void pattern means that there's something in the way or is obscuring certain parts of blood spatter, so that if you see a pattern on the wall of different blood spatters, but yet a blank space in the middle or over towards the edge, that means that there was something that was in the way at the time the blood was spattered and has been removed. So it's the absence of evidence that tells you that there was actually something there.
Let's go into the courtroom.
State of Florida versus Henry Segura, we the jury find as follows. As count one of the indictment concerning the murders of Brandy Peters, the jury finds the defendant is guilty of first degree murder. As to count two, we the jury find as follows. As to count two of the indictment concerning the murder of Tamaya Peters, the defendant is guilty of first degree murder. As to count three, we the jury find the defendant is guilty of first degree murder. As to count four, we the jury find the defendant is guilty of first degree murder.
To Levi Page. Levi, what was the sentence?
Nancy, he was sentenced to life in prison. This was actually a death penalty case, but Segura actually testified during the penalty phase that he didn't want to present any mitigating factors, and if the jury thought that he was guilty, then he deserved the death penalty. But the jury deliberated. They had the option to go for the death penalty, but they decided to go for a life sentence instead.
Well, even now, a defense team is planning Segura's appeal. Nancy Grace, Crime Story, signing off. Goodbye, friend.
You're listening to an iHeart podcast.